morning, everyone. This is Christina Osborne with ISO Stakeholder Affairs, and I'd like to welcome you to the biweekly market update call. Also joining me on the speaker line from the Market Validation and Analysis team is Rahul Kalaskar and Guillermo Batista Alderete. Last Friday, the ISO hosted a special market update call to respond to questions regarding impacts that the recent heat wave had on grid and market operations. We did commit to devote part of this call to responding to additional questions that we weren't able to cover during that call. So we'll start by responding to those questions, and then we'll go over the regular updates that we usually cover on this call. And then at the end, if time permits, we'll open it up for questions. So at that time, if you have a question, you can raise your hand by pressing #2, and we just ask that you start by introducing yourself and who you're affiliated with. The materials related to the market update calls are available on the user group and recurring meetings page. We are also recording the meeting today, and we will post that audio file out on that same web page for a limited time. And just as a reminder, please request permission from the ISO before reprinting any related transcripts. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Guillermo.
Thank you, Christina, and thank you for the introduction. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining this market update call. As Christine indicated, last Friday we have a dedicated call to address questions related to the heat wave. Although we addressed several questions, there are still a few ones that we didn't have time to cover. For this morning call, I would like to first spend a few minutes addressing these pending questions that we couldn't address last Friday, and then we can move into the regular components of the market update call, which covers the market performance also for this heat wave period and also the price corrections. As usual, at the end of the call, we can have the lines open for any follow-up and question that you may have. With that, let me go to the question we have from the last week session. The first question is about whether there needs to be sufficient RA supply to meet all load and exports before allowing self schedules. Let me try to clarify this, because I believe this question is a little bit misplaced, because both load and exports can economically be deemed or self-scalers in the day-ahead market. They may have different priorities that is different, and they will be met with any supply that is available from the market. We cannot color code what electrons go to supply, to demand, or exports. Depending on the type of these resources, different priorities apply, which will determine what resources can be curtailed first and which go last. We are with no challenges when there is sufficient capacity and supply resources on the system, when we have to support these positions from the day ahead. The challenge is when the system is constrained. The positions taken can result in a scale that may be not feasible later in the real time. And this is really the discussion that we have last Friday. Exports are not to ensure that there is additional supply available to meet load. They are effectively additional load that needs to be met with the available supply in the system. I hope that clarifies that point. The second question is whether CAISO is considering to raise the bid cap to $2,000 per megawatt hour to provide greater liquidity and incentives in the market. I think this is a good policy-oriented question for what we need to do in the future. What I can tell you is that we are in the process of the policy initiative for FERC Order 831, in which the bid cap can raise up to $2,000 under certain conditions. And this is basically when there are bids justified with an increase in fuel cost. If a participant considers that this is a topic for further consideration for policy beyond what we have considered so far in the FERC Order 831, I would encourage the participant to submit this topic as a suggested item for our policy roadmap, and this will just go and kick off the formal process to assess any suggested item. There was also a question related to how the CAISO determines the operating reserves. And the operating reserve that we have in the system is a reliability standard. I believe that is the DAL-002. The operating reserves are basically determined by either of two components. That is a 3% of load plus a 3% of generation that is based on our daily load forecast. When we go and run the day-ahead market, that is the first opportunity to set up the requirements for this operation reserves based on the day-ahead forecast that we have for load. And a half of that is going to go for requirements for spinning reserves. The other half is going to go for non-spinning reserves. You may recall a couple of years ago, we have a couple of changes that we have to implement because we have the new requirement to include the largest contingency to be either Diablo or the loss of the PDCI. At some point, we also changed the requirements to accommodate solar cessation. But right now, this is specifically the requirement that we have to determine the operating reserves. There was one question asking why prices in the day ahead were allowed to exceed $1,000 per megawatt hour while convergence bidding was suspended, but they are not allowed to do otherwise. And I think this is a mischaracterization of the of two different interplays. First, prices can exceed the $1,000 level. The cap that we have is on the bids, is not on the prices. Now, so that being said, there are many factors influencing the price level, such as tight supply, congestion, and higher gas prices that we explained last week. So is not one the consequence of the other. Suspension of convergence bid alone will not necessarily result in prices reaching $1,000 level, neither is the trigger to raise the bid caps. The last question that we have in the queue was related to the flexible ramp test. I covered a little bit this topic in the last call, but the most recent question is about some participants indicating that they are not aware that the flexible ramp insufficiency test applies to the CAISO balancing area. What I can tell you, in addition to what we explained last week, is that the flex test applies to each balancing area, including the ISO area. And for you to have the background, you need to go back to 2015. In that year, in 2015, the ISO ran an explicit policy initiative that we call the one-year EIM enhancement. This item of subjecting the CAISO to the flexible ramp test was specifically discussed and addressed during that initiative in 2015. So there is plenty of information and material and discussion around that policy initiative, and the participant can find all the information related to this policy initiative on the CAISO website. If anybody runs into complications how to find that information, we can be very happy to provide you the link where the information is sitting. But again, this was an explicit topic that was with a dedicated discussion of why we move in that direction. So this shouldn't be a surprise to anybody back now in 2020. There were a few questions related to price trends around these days, which I believe can be naturally be addressed in the next discussion of the market performance by Rahul. So I will just hold on those. And these are really the set of questions that we couldn't answer because of the timing last week. So with this, I will now pass it to Rahul to cover the regular material of the call. And again, at the end of the call, we can open up the line for any follow-ups that you may have for either this set of questions or for any questions related to the regular items of the performance call. So, Rahul, I pass it to you now.
Thank you, Guillermo. Good morning, everyone. Let me start this section first with the review of the meeting minutes from the last call. For everyone's reference, we had the last market update call on August 13th. During that call, there were several questions about what happened on July 30th and 31st in the market because there were some relatively high prices in the day ahead and there were some price event in real time. So all of those questions have been answered in the meeting minutes and the meeting minutes have been posted. So I hope you can review those meeting minutes And if you have any follow-up questions, we can take this after I complete the review of the biweekly market performance report. So with that, let me move on to the review of biweekly market performance report. The ISO published the biweekly market performance report for August 5th through 18th. For this two-week period, we observed high demand on the system, mainly between August 14th through August 18th. This high demand is driven by higher temperatures. During this time, we not only did we observe higher temperatures in California, but we also noticed there are higher temperatures in our neighboring states also. At the same time, there was an increase in the natural gas prices. Again, this is driven by increasing demand for natural gas. Due to this high demand, we also observed congestion on various transmission lines within California. That includes the transmission lines that make up the Part 26 constraint. Part 26 is a transmission constraint or a set of lines that connect Northern California with the Southern California. And there was a price separation between the Northern and Southern California, more pronounced on August 17th and 18th in the day-ahead market. During this time, the Southern California edits and the SCE DLAP saw a much higher price than PG&E DLAP. And this high price is driven by congestion on Part 26. And the main reason for this high price is, again, the same two things. We have much higher demand in Southern California. And we also have a lack of imports into Southern California on the tide. And those are due to higher demand in the neighboring states, Arizona and Nevada. Now, moving on to the real-time market. There were periods with sustained high prices during the peak and the net load peak between August 14th through August 18th. Then again, this is driven by higher demand. For this period, we did observe scarcity for ancillary service. And the main scarcity that we observed was for the non-spin reserve. The non-spin reserve scarcity is essentially driven by the fact that some of the resources which were received non-spin award from the day-ahead market, they were committed in real time to provide energy. And ISO will be posting a market notice that provides details of the scarcity events. And we have been doing this for a long time now. There were also high prices between August 14th and 15th, but that has been covered by the prior call. So we will skip any questions because those have already been provided. And lastly, for the period on August 17th and 18th, we were predicting higher loads in the real time, somewhere around 50,000 megawatts. But the load came much lower on these days. So that's why the real-time events were much milder compared to what we saw on August 14th and 15th. So with that, let me pause here and see, operator, if we have any questions about the biweekly market performance report or the section that Guillermo already covered.
We do have two callers in the queue. Caller, your line is now unmuted.
Yeah, Ryle, are you taking general questions, or are you just, this is Seth with DC Energy, are you taking general questions from the heat wave, or are you just wanting people to ask questions about the market report that you just highlighted?
I think we could take both and figure out, you know, how do we go ahead with the response.
Okay, so my questions are more of a follow-up from the heat wave call that we had last week. So specifically, wasn't quite clear to me still after the discussion about suspending convergence bidding. It's still not clear to me why ISO had to undertake those actions if they have a day-ahead, RUC process where they can count their physical units, look at their schedules, and make curtailments, make commitments, and do whatever they need to do in that process. So I just wasn't sure why that process couldn't be used and why you had to resort to suspending convergence bidding. I would note that the markets didn't look well converged, and that seems to be a market dysfunction, not something that should impede reliability necessarily. I was wondering if you could opine on that.
Hi, sir. This is Guillermo. You may be disappointed that I'm going to go back to the previous question and answer that we gave you. And if the same question is being asked, you will hear the same answer because that is really what happened. And let me try to be as clear as possible in this time. When you have plenty of supply available, yeah, the interaction between convergence bids and physical supply is going to take in the IFM market, then we go into the rock market, and then we can back up everything with physical supply. The key point here is that there is sufficient physical supply for this interchange and this offsetting to happen. The problem is when you don't have even physical supply enough to cover the demand. In this case, the convergence bids are going to be backing up potential exports and load that later on we know that cannot be supported, and then we have to start curtailing those in the real time. This is a problem. It's a problem of physical supply not enough to cover even the physical demand and the exports. If you insert physical convergence bid supply, that is going to support potentially additional clearing of those that later you don't have the physical resources to meet.
All right, and we have another question in queue. Caller, your line is now unmuted.
Hi, Rahul. This is Callie Wells with Gridwell Consulting. So I was curious. I know you touched on, or maybe it was Guillermo that touched on initially, when the LMPs in the day-ahead market went above 1,000. I had a similar question, but we noticed the SMEC specifically, so not the – I know the LMP can go above 1,000 with congestion, but – the system marginal energy cost was above 1,000 in a couple intervals in the real-time market. So I was curious if you guys had any, if you can elaborate a little bit more on situations that can cause that to happen.
Sure. This is Guillermo. Let me take that first one. This is far from trivial to understand, but let me try to give a try. The LMP has different components, right? The energy, the congestion, the losses, the GSG. The SMEC is reflective of the condition for power balance, supply equals demand. Like any other condition and constraint that we have in the system, in order to achieve a solution, in some cases we have to relax constraints, including the power balance, and each constraint has an associated penalty price. That penalty price is typically based on the bid cap or the bid floor. So if we have oversupply conditions, the penalty price for relaxation of the power balance for oversupply is going to be the bid floor. If we have undersupply conditions, the penalty price for relaxing the power balance is going to be based on the bid cap of $1,000. The first point that I want to clarify here is that, again, we don't have caps on prices, nor on its components. We have caps on the bid. Naturally, when you have, I would characterize this, if you try to graphically visualize this, you can define two regions where the market operates. One region is the economical range, where you have economical bids meeting supply and demand, and you have flexible variables to be able to meet that balance. Everything is business as usual because it's just the economical range. It's the classical economical theory. Then you move into the second region, that is the non-price region or the penalty-based region. This is the region in which we are really on the edge of one of the market conditions. We are basically in one corner, right? We don't have enough supply to meet demand, and under supply condition, we don't have enough resources to move up or down in Cordec to manage congestion. And when you start going into these zones of not enough economical variables to move to achieve a solution, that is when all these relaxation and penalty prices start to kick in. So going back to your original question, why the SMEC can go over 1,000, why the 1,000 is the reference. The reference is that once you run out of economical bits up to 1,000, what is next is the power balance constraint relaxation, and that sets the price to $1,000. That is more well-defined in the real time. In the day-ahead market, I don't think you will ever see a power balance constraint relaxation because we have demand response and set the schedules. And the fact that the price can exceed the bid cap of $1,000 is really because we're in these stretching corner conditions in which you start having this very stressed interplay between power balance and transmission constraints. So naturally, there may be conditions in which, given this tight definitions of supply and demand together with congestion, there may be some leakage of the pricing signal from congestion losses into the SMEC. And this is not new. This is not the first time this has happened back in August 14 or 17. We had the same discussion with SEE and other participants back in 2014, 2015 as to why this happens. It may happen in both the day ahead, the real time, and strictly speaking, when you have these very extreme conditions in which now the market is operating in this penalty region where you have interactions of different penalty prices. So it is here where the price start to be less intuitive than you could expect when you are operating just in the economical range.
Okay, no, I could really appreciate. No, it does, yeah, because so it's basically it's on the edge of actually violating the power balance constraint because the next interval the SMEC went straight to 1,000, so I recognize that as the power balance constraint being violated. So basically, in some cases, when you're on that edge of relaxing the power balance constraint and setting the SMEC at 1,000, you can get in situations where the SMEC is actually above the 1,000 because that constraint hasn't been relaxed yet.
And there are a lot of interplays. Again, this has to do really with what range of the zone you are operating. In this case, it's all based on the penalty prices, and the interactions of all the penalty prices can give you these counterintuitive solutions. That being said, we are talking about here the price decomposition. At the end, what matters is the full LMP. Whether you have an LMP composed of $1,001 plus $499 of congestion, or you have $1,000 of energy and $500 of congestion, at the end, the LMP is $1,500 regardless. It's a matter of how the interplay starts to show up in the price decomposition.
Oh, no. Yeah, I get that. We were kind of looking at the SMECs and kind of seeing how those evolved during the 14th and the 15th, and that kind of just jumped out. So we were curious as to what situations would cause the SMEC to go above 1,000. And your response answered that, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, Emma, do you have a couple more callers in queue? Caller, your line is now unmuted.
Hi, this is Noor from Olivine. I'm just wondering, how is demand response considered in, how is it accounted for in like the load forecast and the load and generation supply curves, especially supply side demand response?
Yeah. I think the question has two parts. The first one is how the market accounts for that when we dispatch those resources. And the second one is how that could influence the forecast. The first part related how they are dispatched. They are treated like any other resource in the system, even though they are demand response. The system may see those as supply type, and it's effectively the same, right? You increase supply or you reduce demand, the end effect on the balance, it's the same. And based on that, we have the model of these resources like any other resource in the system through the markets. And they have a bid, we dispatch them, we obtain the clearing award for that resource, and it's not different in that sense to any other classical resource. We have a variation that is the reliability demand response that is triggered either when we have high price and we run into an emergency. So we have to go into the emergency mode to be able to dispatch those resources. But the effect of that in the market dispatch is effectively the same. The other question is when these plants are deployed, effectively they are going to reduce in the system the load. And this can introduce some challenges to the forecasting already because the forecast, among many other things, primarily is based on the temperature and weather-based conditions, right? So we do have a process in which we have to try to reverse back the effect of the demand response into the forecasting so that it doesn't contaminate the upcoming forecast. And this is still a process that may have further considerations in the future, but based on what we currently have, is a back of the envelope accounting of how we account for the effect of the demand response to not introduce further noise to the forecast.
So when there are quite several or a couple gigawatts of DR, I think a lot of it was market integrated dispatched during the heat wave. Is there an add back to the load curve for supply side DR, or do all the final load curves include all the load reductions, the physical load reductions that are provided by DR, as if they were load, not generation?
Yeah, well, let me split the answer again in two parts, right? Because the first part is when you are leaving the deployment of the demand response. Right there, when the demand response is deployed, effectively the load is going to reduce. And the load forecast, as you may know, the closer you are to the real time, the more you rely on what just happened, that is a persistency-based approach. So there will be a natural consequence of the load forecast right after we have deployed these resources, because now the demand is going to be lower and we rely on that for generating the upcoming forecast. There may be the second consequence that for the future, in subsequent days, when we are going to use this day as a similar day to generate a forecast for the future, we need to make sure that we account for the effect of that not being based on conforming conditions of the load, but because it was a demand response deployed. That is when we have to put in back the effect of the demand response. Does that
So when there was over 50 gigawatts of projected forecasted demand, I'm guessing that didn't account for demand response, and the actual load did when there was we were only at 47 gigawatts or something. A good portion of that, some of that was voluntary, but a good portion of that was market integrated DR. But I'm guessing that reduction is in the load curves that we saw, that there is not an add back there for DR, right? There's not there were 2 gigawatts of DR, so we're going to add another 2 gigawatts to the load.
No, the load is reflective of what we currently have in the system at that time of the deployment of the demand response.
Okay, thanks. I'm still a little fuzzy over how that fits into the long-term forecast, or to the forecast, given that it is a supply resource, but that's helpful. Thanks.
Well, let me just clarify before we move into that, because let's assume there is 1,000 megawatts of demand response deployed, right? We know effectively the demand is going to reduce by 1,000 megawatts. If we have a correlation that tells us that when you have a day with 105 degrees of temperature, the natural consequence should be a load of 49,000 megawatts. And we go back to the history to find a similar day to rely to define or to develop a forecast. We're going to be looking for those similar days, right? 49,000 megawatts when we have a temperature of 105. Well, why this day has a demand of 48,000 when it should be about 49,000? This is the piece that we have to internalize to ensure that we can still have a forecast that accounts for the effect of that demand response and deployment. And that is for subsequent, for the future forecast that may rely for this day using the methodology that we currently have. Okay, Chris, do we have any other questions?
We do have a few more questions in queue. Moving on to our first caller. Caller, your line is now unmuted.
Hey, it's Eric Little from Edison. So I earlier heard you refer to a stakeholder process for our, I think, RA enhancements on the issue of whether or not the California passed its resource sufficiency test and had access to imports through EIM. I guess I'm looking for kind of a simple explanation here. What I thought I heard in earlier calls was California did not pass its sufficiency test, but still had access to imports in EIM. What I'm trying to understand is, why is that the case? Is it the fact that when you look at the ramping capability in California, you have a flexi ramp product, and so if it failed, you bought flexi ramp, which now means it passes, which means you have access to EIM, or if there's some other variable that's going on that enables those transactions in EIM to occur? So I'm hoping maybe you can give a bit better explanation to help understand that. Rather than going back and trying to read through an entire stakeholder process.
Sure, Eric. And I need to clarify a few points that may be tangling in your question. The first part is not the same to say the resource sufficiency test to say the flexible ramp sufficiency test. One is not the same as the other. The flex sufficiency test is one of the components that make up the resource sufficiency test. That is a key distinction, because when we are talking about the resource sufficiency test, we are talking about balancing test, capacity test, and flexible ramp test. The question here is really about the flexible ramp sufficiency test. We don't need to run a balancing test for the CAISO because we have RAC. We know that we are already in balance, so that is not the issue. The question is really more about the flexible ramp sufficiency test. We don't have anything in place or in lieu of that. When we had the discussion back in 2015, that was the point of discussion. Like any other balancing area, we need to ensure that we have enough ramping capability in the 15-minute basis, in the 5-minute basis, to be able to sustain the ramp changes that we have in the system. That is not offset or supplemented by the RAP process. This is not a balancing test. This is a flexible ramp sufficiency test. And as I indicated, like any other balancing test, the CAISO is also subject to this test. Let me pause here to see if we can go in a more focused discussion.
Okay. So if I understood you correctly, then the tests that are done for EIM are a host of tests. The test of ramping sufficiency is maybe one subset. So it's possible that California had sufficient capacity to be able to participate in EIM, but the ramping needs were a constraint. Is that what I understood you said?
Yes, and it's not a maybe. It's always true.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate that explanation.
You're welcome.
All righty. Moving on to our next caller. We do have a few more callers in queue. Caller, your line is now unmuted.
Hey, Guillermo. This is Seth again from DC Energy. I actually had a follow-up question on suspension convergence bidding, and my line just went blank. So I don't want to revisit it for the sake of revisiting it, but I did have a follow-up response and potentially a question. So it sounds like you did it to improve your situational awareness going into real time, so you wouldn't have to cut schedules, export schedules. But my point was, you could have did that in a day-ahead time frame through your day-ahead RUC process. So that just didn't quite make sense to me, the idea that you had to wait to real time to cut the schedules, when you could have did that in a day ahead time frame to improve, to get rid of this blind spot that you had going into real time. So that's one point I wanted to make. And the other one is, it seems like part of the problem here is the lack of scarcity pricing in the ISO. Whereas if you had the scarcity pricing element, you saw the convergence in the day ahead time frame, you may not see the exports being scheduled and awarded in the first place. And it was particularly concerning to see the divergence during the rolling outages. And I'm wondering what the CAISO thinks about that and if they're planning on revising their scarcity pricing and going into to more of a regime that the other ISOs take on.
Yeah, I think that is a policy-oriented question set. I don't have an answer for that. I don't know what the plan is going to be for the longer term. I think you're raising a good question, and I think that is a valid topic to discuss in the longer term. Where do we want to take this from? And that should be a natural topic that we should put in the roadmap for discussion.
Okay. Any follow-up response to what I said about convergence bidding?
Oh, yeah. I hear you, and still it doesn't align with what really is the functioning of the market. Once you clear a day-ahead export, yes, RAP, that is for reliability purposes, that was intended to be created to ensure that you have enough supply to meet the demand, is not going to unwind that export because the participant can still have options to go and self-schedule the day-ahead award. That is a feature in our market. So once you open the gate, there is no way to retract that.
Okay, thank you.
Alrighty, we do have two more callers in queue. Moving on to our first caller. Caller, your line is now unmuted.
Hi, this is Noah Tom from SDG. Just a quick question. Would the ISO be able to confirm that all the LSEs were sufficient in their RA showings going into August for, I think it should be somewhere around 52,000 megawatts of capacity? And then would the ISO be able to provide?
I don't have information to share at this point. I think we are doing the investigation and analysis. If there is something applicable in this area that is worth to disseminate when we have completed the analysis, I think we will do so. But at this point, I don't have anything to share off or confirm.
Okay, sorry. And Gilmer, did you say that you'd be looking for it in, or we should be looking for it in the MPPF or some other venue?
I think we don't want to go ahead of ourselves. We have first to do the full analysis that we are engaged to do. Once we have that, we will see what type of information and what vehicle we can use to disseminate the information.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Moving on to our last caller in queue. Caller, your line is now unmuted.
Hi, Gemma. This is Wei Zhe from SC. I was a little bit confused about your explanation, I think probably to Kelly's question on the price above $1,500 for SC area. So if past 26 was binding, you know, essentially separate the Northern California and the Southern California, then wouldn't be the marginal resource in Southern California set the price for the Southern California area? Or do you have some other type of network topology that will allow the connection between the Southern and the Northern California? And if that's true, then you have the big cap of $1,000, then why would the marginal resource allow to set the price above $1,000 in that case?
Wait, this is like deja vu. We have had all these type of discussions back in previous years. What I can tell you is that anytime you have one constraint binding, you will not have one marginal resource. You will have two, each on one end of the constraint. That is basic definition of marginality, right? Now, there is a construct here that there is only one constraint binding, that is PAT 26. No, we have many other constraints binding at the same time. Interties, power balance, different transmission constraints. It's not just an isolated case of one single constraint against power balance. Second, the interplay I was referring to is really when you are really reaching the stretch of the invisibility, right? There is this competing priorities. You may have resources that if you ink, you are able to manage the power balance because if you ink, you increase supply and now you can meet your demand. That same ink can hurt some constraints. So some other constraints may give you a price signal that that resource has to be DEC. So when you have all these type of competing priorities that you have to ink and DEC according to the constraint, that is when all this type of interplays may happen and you may end up with this type of results on the prices.
Okay, I think, yeah, I appreciate that explanation. So it's not really just past 26 constraint, it's really all the redispatch and, you know, the resources being moved around causing the high price, I mean, the price above $1,000 big cap.
Yeah, and I think the flow as we saw it that was going from northern to southern was really because of how more expensive the southern resources were, right? We have higher gas prices, we have limited imports, so naturally, if you have more imports in the north, then you flow through the system and try to reach the south. So these are conditions that really stress the conditions that we have to the maximum. And again, it is when you are in this zone of the not-so-economical range where you start seeing this type of interplay. But let me conclude that the key point here is that at the end, the price as a whole is still reflective of the marginal conditions that we have in the system.
Yeah, so what I don't understand is the last part you said. If it's a marginal condition, which to me means marginal resource, and a marginal resource is not allowed to bid above $1,000, no matter how high gas price is, it won't be allowed to bid above $1,000. But the price of the DLAP we see is $1,550, so well above $1,000. I guess your explanation about, you know, how resources move around, you know, causing the price being high, I think I kind of understand that, but I would love to see example. But when you say the marginal condition, that's the part that I was confused. But thank you for the explanation.
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Wei. Yeah, let me dust off because we have had these discussions every other year, I believe, when we see these cases. Let me dust off to the information we have to see if we came with any examples at that time or not. Okay, Chris, do we have any other questions?
Yes, we do have two more callers who got in queue. Moving on to our first caller. Caller, your line is now unmuted.
Yes, hello. This is Michael Rosenberg with M3. Hello, Guillermo. Suppose the market, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes. Suppose the market cap would indeed be $2,000. Would CAISO then consider leaving virtuals in, allowing them to continue to bid during this heat wave? Or is really market cap versus virtual bids is two independent decisions? Higher market cap does not mean that CAISO would consider virtuals on par with physical resources.
Yeah. Hi, Michael. I think we have a lot to do with what we currently have. So I'm not in the mode of entertaining any speculation-based scenarios of what if. So I think we already have plenty on our plate with what we currently have. So I will not go into any speculation.
Okay. And then you also mentioned that currently CAISO does not have an LMP cap. Did I hear you correctly?
Yes, that's correct.
Was there a time in the beginning after MRTU that there was a bid cap or there was never bid cap? LMP cap. Was there never an LMP cap or was there an LMP cap in the beginning and that was phased out?
Yeah, I think you're stretching my memory, but as far as I recall, I think at the very beginning, in order to shepherd the market, we may have imposed some price boundaries at the beginning of the nodal market. But it was a transitional condition, I believe.
Yeah. So right now, LMP can be anything, essentially.
As defined by the marginal conditions of the system, yes.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, and we do have one more caller in queue. Caller, your line is now unmuted.
Okay. Hi, Guillermo. Dan Williams from Customized Energy Solutions. We had some discussion of the EIM transfers relative to the failing of the flexible ramps efficiency test, but just thinking more broadly, when you go in and look at the real-time daily market watch statistics for the EIM transfers over the last week or so, and specifically over kind of the Friday to Tuesday period, it looks like the transfers were very erratic over the evening ramp, and we saw 500,000 megawatt moves, sort of reducing the amount of imports at times and then bringing them back in the FMM and in the RTD intervals. And it's difficult, to know because the numbers are rolled up into kind of a total, and we don't get to see what's going on in the sort of the north or south imports there. Is the CAISO worried at all about that, about the ability for the EIM imports to move so dramatically over these shorter periods? And if not, or even if so, will you be doing more analysis to look at what was driving that and maybe driving it in the north versus south part of the system?
Sure. Let me elaborate a little bit on this. First, I wouldn't characterize this to be erratic. The market is very dynamic. You have changing conditions, not just in one balancing area of the CAISO, but in every single other area that makes up the EIM market. So when you put all these interplays at the same time, obviously you're going to get quite a dynamic changing conditions. Regarding your question about the concerns for the flex, for the ramp or the movements that can happen between intervals, there is a very subtle item here. You have to realize that we don't just allow transfers to happen by any means or with no justification. The transfers on their own is not the purpose. They are the materialization of changes of schedules. If you reduce generation in one area and increase generation in another area, that may materialize in a transfer, right? Because now you have these deltas between two areas. So the transfer is a good capture of all the overall movements, inks and decks of the resources that make up the EIM area. And what it means is that any EIM transfer is fully supported by the physical capability, the ramping capability of resources, because at the end of the day, what is behind the EIM transfers is resource-specific redispatches. And these resource-specific redispatches are subject to any operational constraint that the resource has to comply with and that the market enforces. So if they're going to move a resource 100 megawatts from one interval to the other, it's because it has the ramp capability. So when you aggregate this to the system level, obviously you can see in the range of a few hundred megawatts movement. And that is because all the resources that make the interplay of this are moving accordingly based on the ramp capability that they have. So the EIM transfers are not a variable on their own. They are simply a reflection of the redispatches that we have at the specific resource level.
Yeah, thank you for that explanation. I guess I was referencing back to some discussions that the EIM entities have had about the need to slow down the sort of the rate of change in the transfers, and knowing that those are reflected or are supported by the ramping rate of the resources, it still seems like it's causing a source of extreme volatility. Erratic maybe is too strong of a word, but definitely some volatility on the system during periods when operations are challenged. And it just would appreciate more when you're doing the kind of post-op analysis on this to kind of look at the impact that those changes had over the evening peak and over the ramping issues that were going on during that time, and maybe do a little more follow-up on it at that point.
Point taken. Thank you.
All right. And there are no more questions in queue.
Great. Thank you, Chris. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. Greatly appreciate it. Again, we did record the meeting today. We will post that out on the user group and recurring meetings page. So you can find that by going to the Stay Informed tab, select meetings and events, and there you'll see user group recurring meetings. And I think that's it. So really appreciate your participation. Enjoy the rest of your day. And thank you, Chris, for your help with running the call.
Sure. That concludes our conference. Thank you for using Event Services. You may now disconnect.